Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Oh, a bit of life this week. You can't always count on that. Good morning. I'm Matt. I'm the minister here at Maybridge, if we haven't met. And if you are a guest, let me add to Matt's welcome. It's good there's two Matts this morning, isn't there? It makes life easier. We are, as a church, we do, in every September, we do a thing called Partnership Month. And we are in the last week of that. And we're now in October, actually, aren't we? We've overspilled. We're not into October, but we're still to the last of the 4 weeks on Partnership Month. And the idea of this whole month, we do it every year, is to think about what God wants church to be like, what he's called us to get practical with it. And actually, we're just focusing on what God has always called the church to, and we're just trying to do it in a new way each year. And within that, our vision is that we want to be a vibrant church community that relentlessly follows Jesus and extravagantly shares the goodness of God. That's our vision, that's what we're attempting to do, but alongside that we have some values. You could say these are the sort of the DNA of Maybridge, and those four values are that we do life together, we get stuck in, we're here for you, and we're all about Jesus. So we've done the first of those three we've done in the previous weeks, and today is the most important one. Number four, most important one, so you came to the right Sunday, we're all about Jesus. What does that even mean? So the way that we want to describe this is to say Jesus is at the heart of everything we do. We draw on different Christian traditions as we deepen our relationship with him, prayerfully follow where he leads us, and passionately communicate why he's good news for everyone. But why this? Are we a bit obsessed with this following Jesus thing, making everything about Jesus? Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone not just go, well, yeah, Jesus is one of a number of things that we're into. Why would you not say that? Well, today I want to look at one passage of the Bible. It's in the New Testament letter of Colossians, written to the church in the city of Colossae 2,000 years ago. And it's a book that says a lot of stuff about Jesus. And the author, Paul, was a theological genius, but he was also passionate as well as clever. He was passionate for God. He cared about people. And in this passage, he says 10 things. That's right, 10. You're thinking, how long is this going to be? 10 things about Jesus, which were all reasons why he made Jesus the number one thing in his own life and dedicated his life to telling everyone else, look, Jesus is amazing. You've got to do the same thing. And so here we are, Colossians 1, verses 15 to 20. I'll just read it to you. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. So here we are, 10 things about Jesus from this passage, and I think every one of them is relevant here and now, okay? First one, he's the Son of God. He's the Son of God. The first thing the passage does is describe Jesus as the Son. And immediately, for a lot of people, this is a bit of a weird thing, isn't it? Is Jesus supposed to be God, or is he supposed to be the Son of God? What does that even mean? The simple answer is, he's both. So just, I'm glad to clear that up for you, very straightforward. No, Jesus is not the Son of God in the way that I'm the son of my dad. I'm the son of my dad because obviously he was there first, and then he and my mum created a baby, which was me. Well done them. And that's not how it is with God, but the Bible uses language that we understand to describe the sort of relationship that Jesus, who is God, has with the Father, who is God. It's not that Jesus is like the sort of the biological son of God the Father. What it's doing is describing the internal relationships of God, who is somehow mysteriously one person, yet three distinct persons at the same time. It's very, very hard stuff. Two of those distinct persons within God have a relationship that is much like you would think of a good father-son relationship. That's our nearest human equivalent. Now, a good father-son relationship is, of course, one where there is love from both ends. Neither is more valuable than the other, but the son chooses the role of submission within that relationship, not because he's inferior, but out of love. And that's mirrored in humanity. I am not less valuable than my dad, and my sons are not less valuable than me. But there's a sense in which in life each person submits to the wishes of their parent. I know not all families work like this, but I'm sure you're familiar with families where that's the case. Jesus the Son submits to God the Father in their relationship. Doesn't mean the Father bosses him around. That's not what submission actually means. It means the Son chooses, it's his choice, to put the Father's desires above his own. And the Father chooses to allow him to do this. But it's all couched in mutual love, where both parties do everything for the praise of the other, always have and always will. And so Jesus is the Son of God in a sense that's different from a human son and father, but with certain ways that are similar to a human son and father. This is interesting theology, at least I think it is. But it's also at the heart of many people's questions about God and all the big issues of life. Throughout history, many people have presumed to tell us how to live and what God is like, whether it's religious teachers or ethicists, politicians, even rock stars. But if Jesus really is the Son of God, then all the arguments are done, because he's the key to life. He's the one that actually knows. It's as simple as that. Being the Son of God beats any amount of thinking, reading, album sales. And it's not just that he's got the best credentials. It means the way we understand the central things about reality, about our nature, our purpose, our identity, what it means to flourish as a person. It's found in him, all of it. And that leads to the second thing. He's the image of the invisible God. God is invisible to us, obviously. There's a few passages back in the Old Testament that explain that God is so glorious, he's so majestic, he's so much that we can't even look at him. He's not accessible to us. He's painted in a way that suggests we couldn't even be in the same space as him and live. But the word about Jesus that's used here for invisible also implies something else. God is also unknowable. We're down here, we're limited in so many ways. We're flesh and blood. God is up there, he's cosmic, he's enormous. He's not like anything else in our little tiny frame of reference. And yet in one of the Gospels, the accounts of Jesus' life, Jesus says this thing that would have been shockingly blasphemous. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus is God lowering himself into a form that we can interact with. The Greek word that Colossians uses for image doesn't mean that Jesus is like a photocopy or a clone. It's a word, icon, from which we get the word icon, that means the inner core or essence of that thing. To say that Jesus is the image of God means that in him we see the inner nature, the very being of God. Now, in Jewish thinking, there was a big emphasis on the idea of wisdom. They really liked wisdom and the thought of wisdom maybe existing as some sort of divine power in itself. In Greek philosophical thought, people had the idea of something called the logos, the word or reason of God, which made the universe rational and sustained it. And in this line, where it says that Jesus is the icon of God, it brings together all the wisdom stuff that the Jewish people liked and all the rationality and the reasoning that the Greeks liked and says, it's all in him. The active essence of the divine is not some impersonal philosophy or set of ideas. It's not secret knowledge for really clever people. It's this person, Jesus. And if that sounds a bit intellectual, there's another significance to the word icon. It was a word used by everyday people, just in the marketplace, in the street. People who didn't think about philosophy. And it was used to mean a description or portrait of somebody, especially in a legal contract, their representation. And so this was also saying Jesus is the portrait of God. Maybe that's more easy for us to relate to. Jesus is the portrait of God. In him, you see all the characteristics and the features of God. It doesn't need to be complicated if you're thinking about God. Just look at him, look at Jesus, and then you get the idea. And this is incredible news. Wonder what God is like? Got questions? Look at Jesus. He's not a cheap copy of God. He's God made visible and knowable. Everything about his life screams, God is now knowable. Through what he is, through what he does, God is knowable. Third thing, he's firstborn over creation. And that's the first of a few things that this passage says about Jesus and creation. And when you first look at it, it sounds really weird. It sounds like Jesus is like everybody else. He's just a bit older because he was born first. It sounds like that. But the idea of being firstborn was very significant in ancient cultures and sometimes cultures today. But it's not about being like born first, like physically. It's about having first position. So this is more about saying that Jesus has first position over creation. He's number one when it comes to creation. And some people have argued about this verse, like saying it's, you know, maybe Jesus was created before everything else, but, you know, he was still created. But that doesn't make sense at all, because the rest of the passage says the opposite, and because it uses the word firstborn and not the word created. The Greek word for firstborn is prototokos. If Jesus were first created, it would be prototaisis. It's something else. It's a different word. The reason that the author has probably used the word firstborn is that it ties two things together. Jesus is above creation in timing, he got there first, and he's above creation in power. Think about this. You may have considered this before, you may not. This is saying that before creation itself, Jesus was present. Which makes a lot of sense if he's God. But Jesus, who walked the earth, who became a baby, who spoke to the lowest of the low, is also the God who was present before the creation of every single thing that we know. And to me, this is incredibly practically reassuring if you think about everyday life. Virtually every other explanation of reality, whether it's ancient myths or modern materialism, it pretty much all ends up with saying that we're here by accident. Nearly all of it, all the worldviews. If we're here by accident, nothing matters much when it comes down to it. Which would be sad, but it would make sense. But the point here is that Jesus, the same Jesus who worked as a carpenter and ate meals with normal people and went to weddings and funerals, was there at the beginning of creation. And he's been personally invested in it ever since. And that means that my existence and your existence are not an accident. They're intended. And everything that we personally just sort of bump into in life and happens around us is no surprise to him. It's not outside his power. It's not outside his purpose. Is that not incredible? It's not an accident. Which brings us to number four. Things were created in him and for him. Not only was Jesus present at creation, he was involved in making it happen. You could say he was the architect. Think about how deep this goes. Take something like a human chromosome. Each one in your body contains 20 billion bits of information. Jesus was the architect. Or take something huge. The rings of Saturn are 500,000 miles in circumference and 1 foot thick. And Jesus was the architect. Stuff in the universe works. And it works in harmony from microscopic biology all up to cosmic scale physics because he designed it to. But more than that, creation was made for Jesus. The goal of creation is to glorify him. In other words, to point to him, to throw light on him, to show how great he is. Just as planets and stars and oceans and nations were made for him, so was each individual person. And so as life goes by, you know, we get fixed on our day-to-day stuff, washing, cooking, cleaning and so on, all the trivial stuff that we've got to do. But you were made, even in the things that feel trivial. And maybe particularly if your life right now is hard or it's just a grind or you think nothing exciting is happening, you were made in such a way that your daily trivialities and your small gifts and talents find majestic purpose and meaning because they're placed there as a chance to glorify Jesus. You were made by him, for him. There is no place for final hopelessness in what he has created. Number five, he's before all things, and things hold together in him. This is similar to what was said earlier about Jesus being firstborn over creation, but it hammers home that he's not part of creation. He's creator, not created. Jesus was there at creation, he's the end goal of creation, but in between times, he holds it all together. This is a strong statement. some people, and Christians can get into this, believe in what's called deism. And deism is the idea that God exists and he made stuff, but then he's now like a sort of absent dad. Like he's sort of outside it, he's just disappeared, he lets everything just get on. And unfortunately, as I say, many Christians behave like deists, like everything that God has ever done or will do was a long time ago, and now we just read about it. This reminds us that that's not true. Let's put it like this. The creation that we live in, from every cell to every galaxy, continues to exist in every single moment only because God himself wills it to do so. Only continues because God wills it. One scholar puts it like this. Every law of science and of nature is, in fact, an expression of the thought of God. It is by these laws, and therefore by the mind of God, that the universe hangs together and does not disintegrate in chaos. This is saying one of those shocking things the Bible says to challenge how we see the world. You and I are more dependent on Jesus for our existence than we are on oxygen or water or shelter, whether we believe in him or not. We are more dependent on him for our existence than anything else, believe it or not. And this totally undermines any arrogance, any self-dependent thoughts we might have about life. But think about this. Even when you are at your absolute worst, he still deliberately chooses to maintain you. He chooses that you would be, that you would exist still, even in your worst moments. Now, reading between the lines of this letter, Colossians, it seems that some people in that church in Colossae had started to believe that there were, you know, a number of different divine powers and that between them they sort of held power over creation. Imagine if that was true. Imagine the uncertainty about existence. No, it's all held together by the most trustworthy person there is, trustworthy in his good character and trustworthy in his power to oversee the whole thing. How reassuring. Number six, he's the head of the body, the church. So it moves on from Jesus and creation, starts talking about Jesus and the church. In other words, how he relates to those that follow him. And there's a few occasions in the Bible where the church is described using the picture of a body. And Jesus is always the head, the place of direction and decision making. And this was an important reminder for the Christians who originally read this letter, because as we've said, they were starting to think, well, maybe there's Jesus plus some other things, not sure. And then some of them would start thinking, no, to be a Christian, maybe you need loads of extra intellectual knowledge, that sort of thing. And this says, no. Everybody in the church comes underneath Jesus. There's no secret special knowledge that somebody else has. It's being connected to him, getting to know him better as the head of the body. And brought into today, how good it is that Jesus is the head of the church and not me, not anybody else, not in any church. Because we're human, we don't have the answers. If it's any of us steering the ship when it comes down to it, we're in big trouble. And most churches, most problems that churches have, I think, come about when we forget this. We live in a culture that is so consumeristic. We all get pulled in. It's like a fish that doesn't know it's in water because it doesn't know anything else. And so we end up approaching church like it's a product. And we make ourselves the head and we say, well, I think it should be like this and people should do that. And I want this song to be used. And I want this optimum number of emails in my inbox each week. And I think that children's work should be done in this way. And there's nothing wrong with having opinions. But we so easily slip into developing these opinions with totally the wrong foundation. If we actually believe that Jesus is the head of the church, how much would our way of interacting with church be thoroughly different? Number seven, he's the firstborn of the dead and he's supreme. This is just about the best news that you could possibly ever hear in your life. There's that word firstborn again. This time it's saying Jesus takes the firstborn position, in other words, he's number one, from everyone who will rise from the dead. And it's quite a clever way to use the word, because on one hand it reminds us Jesus is first to rise again, but he's certainly not last. And secondly, it parallels what came before. Jesus has this firstborn role over creation, and he has the firstborn role in salvation, in other words, in rescuing people. Now, we live in a time, of course, where generally death is kept behind closed doors. Unlike most people who've ever lived, we are generally not exposed to much death, unless it's a loved one in their final hours. But we're historically unusual that we don't see much death. Death is real, of course. And there's very little in the news that offers hope. But followers of Jesus, as bad as things get, and for you they might be terrible right now, we've always got this to cling to. He defeated death. He's the firstborn from among the dead. This should be the news every single day. First item on the news, it should be this. Before we get the latest on Brexit or hear about the latest celebrity sex offender, the first item should be Jesus has beaten death. It should be like, welcome to the news, live from Jerusalem, the tomb is still empty. We're hearing reports that sin and death have been defeated forever. There's hope for everybody. That should be how the news starts every day, shouldn't it? Most of the news is bad news, and all of it is less significant than that Jesus has beaten death. So if you're struggling, cling to it. Pray about it. Never be indifferent to it. There's nothing better that could be true in history than this news. And it's the thing that seals Jesus' supremacy in all things. If death could beat Jesus, he would not be supreme in all things. But he has beaten death. And that means that when everything is said and done, Jesus has the victory. He wins. He's supreme in everything. Number 8. The fullness of God dwells in him. Now, sometimes people read this verse in Colossians and they think, well, it sounds like it's saying God looked at Jesus and thought, yeah, you're pretty good. I'm going to put my fullness in you. That's not what it means. The word for fullness was a technical word used to talk about all of the attributes of God, everything about God. And some of the people in Colossae 2,000 years ago were using this term and saying, well, the fullness of God has been spread across lots of really good people at different times. And this puts the brakes on that idea and the word on this idea, because the word for dwell is the key one. It's the word that you would use for a permanent dwelling. There was a different word for a temporary dwelling. And so the passage is saying God's permanent dwelling is in Jesus. And this is so important. Remember back in the Old Testament, God, who you remember, he was distant and unknowable, and he was worshipped only at the temple in Jerusalem. And that's where you went to get close to God. You needed a building. But the fullness of God is in Jesus. Buildings are useful resources. This one's quite helpful. But they're just that, they're a resource. The point is, the fullness of God was never intended for a church building or anywhere that we might meet. It's in him. And that means that God is thoroughly accessible through his Son. You might be sat here today thinking, oh, I agree with this in theory, but I've not experienced that for a while. We do have seasons where it doesn't feel like it's true, but let me tell you again, it is. He is still there. Through Jesus, there is still full access to God. Number 9. Only 2 more, don't worry. God reconciles through him. This is more brilliant news. God is reconciling all things to himself. It doesn't just say people, it says all things. All the rest of creation, because of our sin, because of our wrongdoing, it doesn't just affect us, it affects other people, it affects the world. The whole thing needs reconciling. The direction of traffic is all one way, though. God has never stopped loving us or loving what he created. He doesn't need reconciling to us in that sense. We need reconciling to him. And even though the problem is at our end, it still has to be him that takes the initiative to fix it through Jesus. There's no plan B, because there doesn't need to be. Nobody else could reconcile us to God except him anyway. And you know, I find people get offended. Even longtime Christians get offended by the idea that they need reconciling to God. But elsewhere in the Bible it says, the wages of sin is death. In other words, we earned this. It's our wages. We've caused this problem. It's owed to us. What happens? We've made ourselves God's enemies, and we don't like hearing this, and we think, oh, well, I'm maybe a pretty good person. And compared to other people, you might be, but not compared to God. And in our offense, we can maybe miss the incredible thing that's happening. In Jesus, who we've just seen is incredible for these 8 other things, in Jesus, God turns enemy into family. It's not that he turns an acquaintance into a friend. He turns enemy into family. There's a huge gap. How does he do it? The last thing. His blood makes peace. I think it's wonderful. This passage has all this lofty, majestic language about Jesus. It makes it clear that he's supreme in all ways. And then it boils us down to how God reconciles himself to humanity. And it's because he's willing to have himself nailed to a cross. He's the creator of all things, but here he is, making puddles on the ground out of his own blood. He's the sustainer, but he lets himself be neglected. He's the head, but he lets his body be broken. He lets his creation destroy him. He's over all things, but he makes himself nothing. He reconciles us by allowing us to trample on him. This is the thing that we need, that we always needed for peace between us and our Creator, and it had to be Jesus. The person who took on the sin of humanity had to be human. It needed to be one of us, a representative. But also the person who took on the sin of humanity had to be God. Nobody else is valuable enough or strong enough or loving enough to take it on. There was only one person who could and only one person who did. And that's why as a church we're all about Jesus and why what happened on the cross is the heart of our faith. He subbed for all of us because God loves us too much to leave us alone in our mess. And so those 10 things about Jesus, across all of them, we learn about his relationship with his Father, with creation, and with his people. And the picture it paints is rich. He's the pre-exister. He's the creator supreme. He's the head of the church. He's the sustainer. He's the reconciler. He's the initiative taker. He's the one who is willing to bleed for us. And the question is, as it was for the Colossians 2,000 years ago, why would you look anywhere else? Why would you try to add something in? Why would you worship anyone or anything else? And as a church, we say we're all about Jesus because what else would we be about? Why would any church be about? The goal for anybody who calls themselves a Christian is to say it's all about Jesus. We put Jesus first in our thinking, our money, our identity, our family, our business. Nothing is straightened out properly until he's in first place. And so if we want to be a church where we build this great community and we follow Jesus and we extravagantly share the goodness of God, we have to make it about him in every department of life. If we just lived as though we believed these 5 verses I've talked about today, my goodness, imagine what would actually happen to us and the people around us.